This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
More than $100 million in Oregon sales of $100,000 for their corporate minimum tax. So they actually have a corporate maximum tax. The very largest corporations are paying a lower effective rate than small businesses are. And so what a couple of the initiatives that we filed would do is lift that cap and then apply a 1 or 2% gross receipts tax on their in-state sales above $100 million. We're talking about corporations that have not just more than $100 million in in-state sales, but actually significantly more. And the vast majority of the corporations that would be affected are multi-state or multinational corporations that are headquartered outside of Oregon, but do a lot of business here, and right now they're basically getting a free ride.
Anyone you care to name?
The unfortunate thing about corporate taxes is that it's none of it is subject to public disclosure, and so we don't actually have the list of specific corporations that this would impact. We can just get numbers from the Department of Revenue or the Legislative Revenue Office. They'll tell us how much could be raised and how many corporations would be affected, but not their names.
Well, in the absence of any identity, I'd certainly like to know how many of them there are.
Sure. So corporations with more than $100 million in in-state sales, it's about 150 corporations that fall under that category.
What makes these initiatives necessary, and how has their form been arrived at?
We are in an absolute crisis. It's an absolute school funding crisis. We're in a crisis of funding for our priority services like health care for senior citizens, like safety net services for struggling and middle-class families. You know, right now in Oregon, we have the third largest class sizes in the country, and we have one of the shortest school years. The best-case scenario that we could end up in, we'll still have many school districts cutting teachers, cutting school days. And so we continue to slip backward. We're continuing to disinvest in our future. And at the same time, we're tied for the lowest business taxes in the entire country. And that means we've got these large corporations that aren't based in Oregon, but they make a ton of money here. And they make a ton of money here because they're benefiting from our schools, from our university system, from the basic infrastructure that allows all businesses to thrive, except that they aren't paying very much into that system. They're basically getting a free ride. And so because we need to do something significant, something bold, in order to raise money that we can use to invest in our schools, to invest in the next generation of leaders. And we also need to do something bold to make sure that the very largest corporations who are benefiting from our state are actually paying to invest in those priorities.
For more information, visit OurOregon.org. This is Robin Ryan, and I'm with KBOO News.
A hedge fund caught in a government push to prosecute insider trading has agreed to pay over $21 million in fines to settle a lawsuit. Level Global Investors, which closed in 2011, was accused of trading Dell and NVIDIA stocks while possessing insider knowledge. As part of the agreement announced by the Securities and Exchange Commission, Level Global neither confirms nor denies criminal wrongdoing. Penalties will not be paid by the fund's investors, but rather the fund managers accused of the insider trading. Level Global, at its peak, managed an estimated $4 billion of wealth.
The company which formerly managed the Rose Garden has announced that it will lay off over 900 employees. The layoffs, which will take effect on June 30th, come after Los Angeles-based AEG Facilities, replaced by Rip City Management and the Portland Trail Blazers basketball franchise, who announced last week that they will also take over managerial duties for Memorial Coliseum, in addition to the Rose Garden. Layoff workers will have the opportunity to reapply for their jobs, according to Trail Blazers representatives. One representative for AEG said that while some of the positions being terminated are union jobs, the layoffs are considered permanent and no bumping rights will grant terminated employees new employment.
Today, veteran NBA player Jason Collins publicly announced that he was gay via an essay he wrote for Sports Illustrated published online this morning. Collins, who has played center for a handful of NBA teams spanning a 12-year career and spent last season with the Washington Wizards and Boston Celtics, became the first active male athlete in a major professional sports league to publicly come out. In his piece, Collins wrote, quote, "I wish I wasn't the kid in the classroom raising his hand and saying I'm different. If I had my way, someone else would have already done this. But nobody has, which is why I'm raising my hand." New York Times sports columnists Bill Roden and David Gillen discussed the potential effect of Collins' announcement.
How big a deal is this for pro sports?
Well, you know, it's a big deal. It's a big deal. I mean, it's kind of silly that in 2013, somebody saying I'm gay is kind of, but it is. The NBA is a huge business, and that's why you haven't had a lot of this stuff, because there's a lot of peer pressure. There's a lot of pressure from fans. How is this going to play out? So, yeah, it is a big deal. And the fact that it's a guy named Jason Collins who's been in the league for a long time, well-known, you know. So, yeah, it is a big deal. It is a big deal.
You know, my question is, like, do fans care? Do fans care anymore?
Yeah, oh, heck yeah. Are you kidding me? Yeah, just coming up here from Harlem.
All right.
You know, no, fans do care, trust me. You know, he's a free agent. Jason is a free agent. Yeah. And we're going to find out just how much people care.
This is a really interesting point, as you say. He's a free agent.
Right.
And so we're going to find out, you know, who picks him up or who doesn't. Do you think teams are going to embrace him or shy away, or we're just going to have to wait and
see? As we speak, there are those discussions right now in a lot of front offices. How is this going to play out?
The reaction from other sports celebrities on social media has been positive, with Collins receiving support from Kobe Bryant, Steve Nash, and Jason Kidd, among other NBA stars. Other players who were retired when they came out include football's Isaiah Tuolo, baseball's Billy Beane, and former basketball player John Amici. Female athletes who have come out include tennis star Billie Jean King and WNBA star Cheryl Swoops. This year's WNBA first draft pick, Brittany Griner, came out this month as well. Jason Collins will become a free agent as of July 1st.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned for Free Speech Radio News at 5:30, followed by Labor Radio, discussions on working class issues at 6. At 6:30, it's Prison Pipeline, connecting with the community inside. At 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tomorrow's weather is expected to be another mostly sunny day, highs near 62 degrees. Tomorrow evening should have mostly clear night skies with lows around 39.
It's 5:12, time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
Big doings in Big D. The George W. Bush Presidential Library, Museum, and Institute has opened with elaborate fanfare. And what a piece of work it is. A $250 million, 226,000 square foot edifice on 15 acres. Never has something so large been built to contain something so small, namely the thoughts and record of achievements by this two-term president. His brick and limestone structure is certainly imposing, but once inside, you quickly see that it's a $250 million can of whitewash. Of course, all ex-presidents want libraries that show their good side, and Bush himself was organizer-in-chief of this monumental altar to, well, to himself. What's most striking is not what's in it, but what's not. For example, where's that mission accomplished banner that he used as a political prop in May 2003 when he strutted out so fatuously on the deck of the USS Abraham Lincoln, wearing a flight suit to pretend like he had won the Iraq War? And how about a video loop of him finally showing up in New Orleans after Hurricane Katrina, cluelessly praising his infamously incompetent emergency management honcho with a now notorious shout-out, Heck of a job, Brownie. Also, while there are 35 featured videos, a replica of W's Oval Office, narrated presentations by top Bush officials, and even statues of the family dogs, where's Cheney? Shouldn't there be an animated exhibit of the vice in his dark chamber, scheming to shred our Constitution and set up an imperial presidency? Another essential element of George's tenure that goes unportrayed here would be called the Dead Garden of Compassionate Conservatism. This is Jim Hightower saying, why spend $250 million when they could have said it all with a $25 a gallon can of whitewash?
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to. For information, visit hightowerlowdown.org.
Early this morning in Spalding, Oklahoma, two protesters locked themselves to TransCanada equipment with the goal of halting production on the controversial Keystone XL tar sands pipeline. The protesters, Benjamin Butler and Eamon Treadaway Danzid, are part of the Great Plains Tar Sands Resistance, a coalition of groups and individuals with the joint goal of stopping the expansion of tar sands infrastructure throughout the Great Plains. KBOO's Sarah Sneath spoke with Eric Whalen, the spokesperson for the Great Plains Tar Sands Resistance.
Can you tell me a little bit about what happened this morning?
Today, Eamon and Ben locked themselves into a piece of pipe that both of their arms went in, and they locked themselves in such a way that the equipment wasn't able to be used. Eventually, they had to bring in the fire department. They used the jaws of life to break them out of the pipe that they were locked to. Their goal was to halt construction of that pipeline.
How long were Ben and Eamon locked to the machinery?
I believe that we got them locked down at like 6 o'clock, 6 a.m., and then they were extracted after 9 a.m.
And what was the result of their actions?
The result of the action is that we halted construction of the pipeline for 3 hours. The personal results for Ben and Eamon is they were arrested and taking to the county jail.
And have they been released?
Yes, they have. They were released today on bail, and they are coming back to Oklahoma to hang out.
And what is the Great Plains Tar Sand Resistance?
The Great Plains Tar Sand Resistance is a coalition of groups who are dedicated to resisting the exportation of tar sands from Alberta, Canada, through the middle of the United States.
And why stop the tar sands infrastructure?
Tar sands is a very problematic resource. In order for the tar sands to move through a pipeline, like they're planning to do, they have to mix it with diluents that are very toxic. We don't know exactly what the diluents are. It's a trade secret. So they're using corporate law to block the public from having access to what chemicals are passing through their own backyard. Another concern is that all pipelines leak, like what happened in Mayflower, Arkansas, or the Kalamazoo River in 2010. So the concern is that whenever we're out scouting to see where this pipeline's being laid and see where it's being put in the ground, there's a lot of water nearby, and it's running really close to a lot of neighborhoods and a lot of homes. And it's going through land where people make their livelihoods. So it could potentially spill like it did in Mayflower, Arkansas, and poison the land, the air, the soil, the people, the animals, everything within its vicinity.
And it's my understanding that there are some indigenous communities that are especially vulnerable in that area?
Yes. Most of the pipeline, as it comes through Oklahoma, is running through indigenous land. This land is being taken through eminent domain by the corporation TransCanada. So we're very concerned with the effects that it's going to have on the indigenous communities within our state and abroad.
Does the Great Plains Tar Sand Resistance have further actions planned?
Well, I can't give any specifics about what's happening in the future, but we are still present in Oklahoma and we are still active.
Is there anything that you'd like to add?
Yeah, I would just tell anyone who's listening and who hears this interview, if they're interested, they can check out gptarsandsresistance.org. Check out our website. They can find out more, specifically the coalitions that are involved and some of our points of unity about what we're all about. Also, through that, if people want to support us, whenever we have actions and people are arrested by law enforcement, we have a way that people who are supportive but can't be doing actions themselves can donate money to help pay for court fees and bail and all the costs that are accrued by doing direct action.
Is the Great Plains tar sands resistance predominantly located in Oklahoma?
Correct.
Okay. Well, thank you so much, Eric.
Well, thank you.
Have a good day.
You too. Bye.
This has been Sarah Sneath speaking with Eric Whalen, the spokesperson for the Great Plains tar sands resistance.
An explosion and fire at an oil refinery near Detroit has brought to light a number of issues with the company that owns the facility. Marathon Oil is under investigation following the blast, which led to the mandatory evacuation of hundreds of residents. The company recently spent over $2 billion to expand the refinery in order to process more heavy crude oil from tar sands. The crude tar sands oil will be imported from Canada via the Keystone XL pipeline. Just prior to this weekend's fire, Marathon Oil bought up dozens of acres of property around the refinery, allegedly to create a buffer zone. Local residents have reported that cleanup crews are wearing respirators and are concerned about the possible release of toxic chemicals into their neighborhood. The Marathon Refinery in Melvindale, Michigan, is the fourth largest refinery in the nation and the only refinery in Michigan. The cause of the fire has not yet been determined.
On Monday morning, efforts to place a moratorium on hydraulic fracturing received their first public hearings in California. Opponents of the practice are attempting to ensure that the oil drilling technique does not endanger public health. Fracking has drawn scrutiny in other states and has just recently become an issue of high interest in California. Oil companies are looking to expand production from the Monterey Shale Formation, which stretches from Kern County north through the San Joaquin Valley. It's estimated to be one of the country's largest oil shale formations. States' environmental regulators are crafting new rules, but they're not expected to be enacted until next year. Three assembly bills are up for consideration, carried by Los Angeles area Democrats. One bill would stop fracking until further legislation is enacted outlining how it can occur. Two similar bills call for creating an advisory committee to review health, environmental, and economic effects. The bills would require state officials to decide by January 2019 if fracking can be performed safely in California.
A federal judge has ruled that a military training camp in Georgia must release the names of its instructors. The School of the Americas, which was recently renamed the Western Hemisphere Institute for Security Cooperation, is based in Fort Benning, Georgia. It is run by the U.S. military and provides training in so-called advanced interrogation techniques, otherwise known as torture, to military officials from Central and South America. U.S. District Judge Phyllis Hamilton ordered that the names of students and instructors at the school must be released to the public. Today, KBOO's Jimmy Tardy spoke with Hendrik Voss with the School of the Americas Watch, the group which filed the lawsuit, about the ruling.
Tell me what this means for SOA Watch.
Yes, thanks so much for having us on the show, and we are really excited about this court victory. It has been coming for a long time. SOA Watch has compiled the names, courses, rank, and country of origin for all graduates of the School of the Americas from 1946 to 2004. In 2004, after the Pentagon had renamed the school, as you said earlier, to Western Hemisphere Institute for Security Cooperation. And at that point, they claimed that they will no longer allow human rights abusers to attend the school and that they've got a very stringent vetting process and that everything from now on will be better. So at that point, SOA Watch did research on the very recent graduate. And of course, we found names of known human rights abusers like Francisco del Cid, who was named in the United Nations Truth Commission report about the civil war in El Salvador. He was named as being responsible for the Las Ojas massacre, and he was invited back to WINSEC, the supposedly new school, the reformed school. And then also we found other people who were involved in torture, who were involved in drug trafficking. And we compiled a briefing paper that we gave to the media and that we gave to Congress to show that there is no change taking place at the school, that it's still the same school with the same mindset who are training repressive Latin American militaries to do the dirty work for the Pentagon. And at that point, we worked with our friends in Congress, with Representative McGovern, to introduce legislation that would make the names public again. Twice, we won in the House of Representatives, but both times the Senate was taking our victory away. After those two losses in Congress, we went to the courts and we filed a lawsuit against the Pentagon, saying that the Freedom of Information Act has been violated by that secrecy and that the Pentagon has no grounds of denying us the names. And this is what now finally, last Monday, we got the judgment that the judge ruled in our favor, and so that the Pentagon has to release the names. At this point, they have neither the Pentagon and the Justice Department, which represented the Pentagon. They will have 90 days to appeal the ruling, but we are very confident that we have a very clear-cut case that the names need to be made public. So even if they would appeal, I think we will be able to win and that we get the names.
Do you know when the bill was in conference committee, what legislators managed to slip in the language to protect the names from being released?
When the Congress was dealing with the issue and the conference committee between the House and the Senate was talking about the language about releasing the names, one of the people that was very opposed to us and to the release of the names was Senator John McCain, who actually also then was asking the Pentagon to provide him with talking points about why the names should not be made public. And of course, there are no good talking points for keeping the secrecy because they know that known human rights abusers are being trained at the school and they know what the trainees are doing with their training in Latin America. They are not going to defend their country against invading armies because there has not been a war in Latin America between countries for decades. But those soldiers are using the skills that they are being trained at WINSEC, at the School of the Americas, to fight against their own people. What we see over and over again in Latin America is that there are anti-privatization protests, and then the military is attacking those protests. For example, there was, before Evo Morales came to power in Bolivia, there was an anti-privatization protest against water privatization, and a sharpshooter was shooting into the crowd, killing a 17-year-old. And the sharpshooter, he received sharpshooter training at WINSEC. So that's what he used his skills for. Now things have changed in Bolivia that since Evo Morales is the president, it's a president who himself was on the receiving end, and the social movement that he was part of were on the receiving end of SOA violence. And he made the decision to withdraw all Bolivian troops from the School of the Americas. And so Bolivia is one of six countries that have made that decision. Most recently it was Ecuador and Nicaragua, who last year also denounced the school and decided to withdraw their soldiers. So we see that this court decision, in light of also the recent setbacks of the School of the Americas, and we think it's just a matter of time until this relic will finally be closed.
That was Hendrik Voss of the School of the Americas Watch speaking with KBOO's Jimmy Tardy earlier today.
31 protesters were arrested this weekend in upstate New York for blockading the entrance to the Hancock Air Force Base to oppose U.S. drone policy. Hancock is the control base for many of the U.S. drone operations overseas. For more, KBOO's Jenka Soderberg spoke with John Amidon, one of the people arrested at the protest.
Let me just get started by asking you to tell us about the protest at Hancock Air Base.
Okay, well, we had a weekend of conferencing and protesting and convergence to action. This group of people who assembled, we absolutely refuse to be complicit with our government's war crimes, with government-sanctioned murder, with kill lists, with political assassinations. And we also very much feel that we are obligated by the Nuremberg Principles and the U.S. Constitution and the U.N. Charter to make our government aware of their crimes. It is a legal obligation, which is part of the law of this land. So that's what we're doing. We are civilly obedient people performing civil resistance, making the government aware of its war crimes, of its criminal activity.
What led you to make the decision to get arrested for your beliefs?
I started learning about U.S. war crimes when I went to massacre sites in Guatemala and other places in Central America. And I went and I listened to the widows talk about what happened to their village and how their relatives were murdered. And I learned that our U.S. foreign policy and my taxpayer dollar was funding these wars and these massacres to a large degree, and I'm responsible. It's my money, and if I don't say something, I'm complicit. And, you know, I refuse to be complicit with war crimes if I can possibly help it. And I certainly don't tolerate murder and political assassination as an instrument of of our government. I believe that's illegal. I think any kill list program is an obscenity, and that basically that President Obama should be charged with murder, much like George Bush should be charged with murder, and just about every president we have had. So I feel really strongly about it, and it's partially out of my real direct experience as being a Marine and being lied to, and finding out subsequently that there was no real reason for the war in Vietnam. And it's certainly very, very clear with the war in Iraq that we were lied to, and that this country didn't attack us, and that the evidence Colin Powell and George Bush presented, and that whole gang of thugs was false, disingenuous, despicable, and criminal. And people are trying to prosecute them as well they deserve to be. You know, and there are spiritual beliefs, too. I mean, basically, the Golden Rule and the Ten Commandments, you know, I don't believe in killing as a way to solve my problems. I think it's morally wrong. I think it's ethically wrong. And I think it's illegal. So I'm saying something about it. I wondered where the responsible adults were when I was a kid. And I'm trying to be a responsible adult as a U.S. Marine. I swore an oath to uphold the Constitution of the United States, and that's exactly what I'm doing, is upholding the Constitution of the United States by bringing these war crimes to the attention of my government. And that, in brief, is why, you know, I'm doing what I'm doing.
Again, I've been speaking with John Amidon, who is with Veterans for Peace in upstate New York. This is Jinka Soderbergh with KBOO News.
Millions of dollars in secret CIA cash has been sent to Afghanistan over the past decade, according to a report in today's New York Times. The cash was reportedly delivered monthly to the offices of Afghan President Hamid Karzai in suitcases, backpacks, and plastic bags. The CIA money was intended to buy influence in the government, but critics say it simply fueled corruption in the country. Afghan officials told the Times that the secret cash was handled by Karzai's National Security Council, some of which made its way into the hands of drug lords and politicians with ties to the Taliban. Whether the Afghani president personally received any of the cash is unknown. U.S. officials told the New York Times that the secret CIA cash is undermining efforts to stabilize the country, with one official saying that, quote, "the United States is the biggest source of corruption in Afghanistan." Unlike the billions of dollars in formal aid sent to the war-torn country, the so-called ghost money is not subject to U.S. government oversight and reportedly breaks no U.S. laws.
And now the latest news and developments from the occupied territories in Palestine from the International Middle East Media Center in Bethlehem.
Welcome to Palestine Today, a service of the International Middle East Media Center, www.imemc.org, for Monday, April 29, 2013. Israeli settlers attack villagers, leaving two injured, and take over Palestinian-owned lands in northern West Bank. These stories and more coming up. Stay tuned. Two Palestinian civilians were injured on Monday after they were attacked by armed Israeli settlers near the northern West Bank city of Nablus. Fawzin Sera, 50, and Abd al-Rahman Khatib, 60, sustained light wounds when settlers attacked homes at the village of Beit Furik near Nablus, local sources reported. Israeli settlers also on Monday took over Palestinian farmers' lands from the village of Azmut near Nablus and started to plant trees. Local sources said that armed settlers arrived at the area on Monday morning and forced owners out and then took the land. Elsewhere, Israeli soldiers demolished three Palestinian homes on Monday morning in the At-Tur area in occupied East Jerusalem, rendering at least 30 Palestinians homeless. Witnesses told local news sources that two army bulldozers accompanied by several military jeeps invaded the area and demolished three homes that belongs to Ghaith family. Sources added that the army previously forced the residents out of their homes three times under the pretext that they were built without construction permits. Local organizers say that the area in question witnesses frequent attacks and violations carried out by Israeli soldiers and extremist settlers as it falls under the area Israel illegally classifies as National Garden. In the Gaza Strip on Monday, an explosive charge was placed and detonated in front of the home of Fatah official in the Rafah district in the southern part of the Gaza Strip, leading to excessive damage to his car and home. Media sources in Rafah reported that the attack targeted the home and car of Munzer al-Bardawil in Al-Junayna neighborhood in Rafah. He is an official of Fatah movement headed by Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas. Security sources in Gaza reported that a small explosive charge was placed in front of the home of al-Bardawil and was apparently remote detonated, causing excessive damage to his car and the main door and windows of his home. The sources added that the Palestinian security officials and police arrived at the scene and sealed the area in order to initiate an investigation into the attack. And that's all for today from the IMEMC News. This was the Monday, April 29th news roundup from the occupied Palestinian territories. For more news and updates, please visit our website at www.imemc.org. Today's report has been brought to you by Hassan Kassis and me, Ghassan Bannoura.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032.
Our production team for tonight's newscast is Robin Ryan, Jimmy Tardy, Sarah Sneath, John Rasmussen, Evan Owen Stiley, and Mike Klepfer. The producer is Serena Fong. Our engineer is Rebecca Ney. And the KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Jenka Soderberg.
A podcast of local stories from this newscast